Olivet Discourse, Part 3, the third talk in a series on the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24 and 25, was presented by Ron Julian on July 14, 1996, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We've been in Matthew 24, talking about the Olivet Discourse, and I've been trying to give you some sort of perspective on what I think, at any rate, is at the heart of this. It's kind of a difficult line to draw. The topic of the second coming of Christ has been, I think, sort of downplayed and overplayed in various parts of the church, depending on where you are and how you look at it. But in some ways, the topic of the second coming has sort of become, I don't know, to me it sort of seems like it's taken on the flavor of a kind of a conspiracy theory. I mean, people gather together and have you heard that supermarket scanners now are going to do this? And go, oh, now Jesus is going to be back at any time, and that kind of thing. And it gets, I think, at times it gets sort of ridiculous. On the other hand, the fact is that the second coming of Christ is presented very clearly in the Bible as our great hope. I mean, the Bible says that Jesus is going to come back, and His return is going to mark that time when God is going to judge the earth finally, when He is going to make things right and establish His kingdom and bring His people into an eternal life of righteousness and holiness and love. In general, He talks about how God is going to pour His kindness out upon His people. So that's a great thing. I mean, that's the focus of the biblical teaching in some ways. So we're sort of trying to find that balance between getting ridiculous in our, let's count up the number of letters in Bill Clinton's name and see if we can somehow get it to turn into 666, or on the one hand, or on the other hand, just sort of cruising along as if, in fact, the return of Christ is not the great event that we're waiting for, because it is. We're looking at the Olivet Discourse when Jesus is talking to His disciples, and I think it's important to have perspective on what He's trying to do. What is He saying here? This is not His attempt to sit down and tell us all everything that's going to happen, and how can you know down to the last detail, the Antichrist does this and then this happens. That's not what sort of thing this is. He, from the perspective of 2,000 years ago, is speaking to His disciples and telling them, look, this is what I would understand. Look, I think you have this idea that because I am here and I am the Messiah, because I am, that the kingdom of God is about to happen immediately, and you're expecting that this is all just going to wrap up and, it's all over but the shouting. But what I want you to understand is that, in fact, this whole thing is going to take a long time. I have talked of the destruction of the temple, and yes, it's going to happen. This city, the city of the Messiah, the city of the Messiah's people, the center of the worship of Yahweh in the world, this city is going to be destroyed, and its people are going to be taken off into the nations. This is what I've predicted, and I'm telling you that's what's going to happen. And it's going to happen within a generation. This generation will not pass away until these things take place, he says. And I think he's talking about these events that he described. Crucial, important events. If you think about the Messiah coming, it's almost unthinkable that the king of Israel would come and that Jerusalem would not become immediately the center of the world, the capital of everything. And yet what he's saying is, no, the fact is that the place is going to be destroyed. And what that means is that you as my disciples and all people who follow me, he's saying, are facing a period of time when I am not going to be here. And you're going to have to deal with that fact. You're going to have to live with the fact that you're going to be living in a world that is hostile to me, and I will not be here. And in fact, I can't even tell you when I'm coming back, because I don't even know when I'm coming back, is what I understand him to be saying. I couldn't tell you when it's going to happen because I don't know when it's going to happen. But I can tell you that you need to be prepared for it to be a long time. And then he describes the end when there are cataclysmic events on the earth. There is a great sign in the heavens, and he returns in glory and gathers up his people. That's what I understand him to have been saying. He said very little about, you know, from our perspective, what's going to happen in the future and how is it going to go down. But he has told all of us as believers from that time until now that the way things are going to happen is he is going to be gone and we're going to have to live with that. That's what we're going to see here as we move on in Matthew 24 and into 25, that the main part of his theme is this reality that we have to face. You could think about life as being just typical, ordinary, run-of-the-mill human existence. We just go along doing whatever we want, and then someday we'll die, and I don't want to think about it right now. But in fact, Jesus is saying if you get a good picture of reality and what's really going on, this is the way you ought to think about it. There is a period of time that I'm going to be gone in which those who are my disciples are going to be called upon to be faithful, to believe in me, to obey me, to follow me, and there is a day coming when I am going to return and there will be an accounting made. So mostly what he's trying to get across to his disciples here is the need for perseverance in the face of what could be a very long time before he comes back. We're in a position to understand what he means because it's been almost 2,000 years since he said these things, and I call that a long time. So it's not as shocking to us as it was to the disciples because we already know that part of the story and how it happened. But to them, this all would have been very unusual. Now, let me clean up some details here before we get into the parables that end his teaching in this section. In Matthew 24:31, I didn't talk about this last time. It says, he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. I'd like to connect that up with what follows in Matthew 24:37. For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For as in those days, which were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, they were marrying and given in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. So shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Then there shall be two men in the field. One shall be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and one will be left. This is not a really important part of this teaching, but I suppose that I ought to just make a comment, since probably many of us are familiar with the teaching concerning the Second Coming, that there is a very popular teaching, which I'm not convinced is true at this point, that says that there is going to be this 7-year period of tribulation on the earth at the end, and that Jesus is going to come back before that period of time secretly and snatch away Christians, and then this great period of tribulation will happen, and then he will come back in 7 years with the believers that he had taken away. So, if you've ever heard people talk about a pre-tribulation rapture, that's what they mean. They mean the secret coming of Jesus where people get, the believers get snatched up, and unbelievers are left in the, on the earth to face this terrible period. I don't know, maybe I'm just dating myself here, but I don't know if you remember the song by Larry Norman, "I Wish We'd All Been Ready," where, which basically that was the picture that it was painting. It was sung by someone who had not been a believer, who's left on the earth during this terrible time. And I wish we'd all been ready, saying basically, I wish we had been prepared for Jesus to come back. I wish we had been believers so that we would have been taken away and not faced this terrible situation. Well, I don't have any intention of going into the ins and outs of that teaching. All I point out here is that in the Olivet Discourse, it is very difficult to fit that model into what Jesus is saying here. Because it is at the in the Olivet Discourse, it is clearly at the time when there are these great signs in the heavens and Jesus returns that his angels are sent out to gather his elect from the four winds. And this time of down in 27 through 41, this picture of two men in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. It's very, I think we have a sort of a popular notion that that is a description of that rapture, that secret rapture, when there will be the Christian will be snatched away and the unbeliever will be left there and left to face this tribulation. But you can see in the context of the Olivet Discourse, that can't be what he's talking about. I mean, because this is the stuff that happens when the Son of Man comes in glory. Not secretly, but I mean, you know, we're talking about the trumpet and the signs in the heavens and the earth and the so on. Just for what it's worth, not at all an important issue, really. It's not going to change your life one way or the other, I'm sure. But it's not at all clear in that thing where it says two are taken, you know, one is taken and one is left. It is not at all clear that it is the believer that is being taken away in that picture. Because notice how it says, they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. The picture is of Noah getting in the ark and then the rest of the world being swept away by this judgment that comes along from God. So it's not at all clear that the one that's taken in this spot isn't the one who has been caught up for judgment. Just like John the Baptist talks about, he will gather the sheaves into the barn, but then the chaff will be burned up. I mean, which taking are we talking about? The one group goes over here and one group goes over here. So, for what it's worth, I don't think that this passage really much supports that kind of thing. And those who teach, in fact, the secret rapture, many that I'm aware of would admit that that's true, that this passage is not teaching that. And that the people that are being gathered up here, the elect that are being gathered up, are just Jewish believers who emerge through the time of the tribulation, and the secret rapture that they teach is not at all discussed in the Olivet Discourse anywhere. And I think that's the best we could say. If it's true, which I'm not convinced that it is, but if it's true, Jesus doesn't mention it. In this teaching, he doesn't talk about it. Okay? The important part of all that for his purposes, obviously, is not to spell out a chronology like that, but for us to understand that the second coming, his return, is a day of reckoning. It is a day that we need to be prepared for, in the sense that there is a judgment that is going to be associated with it. God's people are gathered up into his kingdom. The enemies of God are going to ultimately face judgment. So, when he talks about the days of Noah, the whole point that he's trying to get across is, remember, here was this time when God's judgment came upon the world, and yet it was only Noah and his family that were prepared, that had heard that it was coming, that believed that it was coming, and thus were prepared for it when it came. Jesus' purpose in the Olivet Discourse primarily, I think, is to warn us, starting with his disciples then, but to warn all of us that the period of time that was coming was a time that would call on us to be faithful, to believe that He was coming back, and to be prepared for it. Not in the sense of knowing when He was coming back, not in the sense of having figured out when He was coming so that I would know when it happened, but prepared in the sense that I was following Him when it happened. I remained faithful. I was one of those who ultimately was accepted and welcomed instead of rejected. So when we start reading then in Matthew 24:42, "Therefore be on the alert, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming. But be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known at what time of the night the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert and would not have allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason you be ready too, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think He will." This idea of being on the alert is a very important one. It shows up a lot in the New Testament. Jesus' whole point here is not be on the alert, be on the alert in the sense of figure out when I'm coming so that you'll be there ready when I do it. His point instead is you can't know when I'm coming. So you need to be on the alert in the sense of being prepared always. You need to be prepared whether I come early or whether I come late. You need to be ready. Ready in the sense of being faithful, believing what He has said, following Him, listening to Him, not disregarding Him and turning away and pursuing some other worldly thing, but hearing what He has to say and following Him. His point is, you think about that thief who comes in the middle of the night. That would be a lot easier to deal with if he would send a card in advance saying, "I'll be there next Thursday evening, 2 a.m, so be ready." Thieves would not be particularly troublesome to deal with if they did that. But the whole point is that they break in on you unawares. You're going along thinking, "My stuff is my stuff. I'm going to go home and it's going to be there. I'm going to go to bed and when I get up in the morning, all my stuff's going to be there." But the thief in the night breaks in at that time when you didn't know he was coming. And that's the reason that you weren't ready and everything went. Unless, the picture he's summoning up is, if I was really concerned about my stuff being stolen, then I have to live in this state of sort of perpetual readiness. I have to be prepared at all times for the thief to come because he's not going to tell me when he's coming, so I have to be ready always to deal with him. Well, that's what Jesus is saying. In a sense, he's like a thief in the night. He's not going to announce when he comes back, which is going to require humanity, at least those who are interested, to live in such a way that his return could be immediate or it could be long in coming. Both of those things are going to be called upon. And that's what the parables that come now are all about. If you think about these parables that we're about to look at, and I don't know how far we'll go, maybe just one. We have a story about a slave who's left on guard, left to take care of other servants while the master is gone. We have a story about maidens who are waiting for the bridegroom to come, but he ends up taking longer than they thought. We have a story about servants who are given some money to invest and take care of while the master is gone, and then he comes back and gives a reckoning. And finally, we have a story about the sheep and the goats, the story of Jesus returning and judging people on how they treated him while he was gone. And it's that irony of these people are being judged by how they treated him while he was gone that fuels that story. All of the parables are tied together by this theme that Jesus is saying, look, I'm going to be gone, but the fact that I'm gone doesn't mean that you're not going to have to deal with me. You are going to have to deal with me, even though I'm not here. and you're going to have to deal with my absence in various ways. I could show up sooner than you expect and catch you unawares. I could show up later than you expect and you'll give up and not be persevere and be there when I come. You might take my absence as an excuse to do nothing. And you'll find out when I get here that that's not going to be good enough. And you might think that my being gone means that you don't really have me to deal with. But I'm telling you that when you're dealing with those people out there, you're dealing with me. And so you're going to have to dial that in. That's what these parables are about. I'm telling you in advance that the point of them is to show us that in the midst of our lives today, we have to deal with the absence and the sure coming of Jesus. We have to deal with it. If we don't deal with it, that's a way of dealing with it. If we just ignore it and put it aside and forget it, that's a way of dealing with it, and he's telling us what's going to happen if we do that. Okay? Is that clear where we're going here? I like these parables a lot. Yes, sir?
So they're asking about right now. It's almost like I hear you saying that he's saying, look, I'll tell you it's not going to happen right now, because what you think is going to happen isn't going to happen right now. Instead of Jerusalem becoming the capital, Jerusalem is trash. But if you want to know when it's really going to happen, you don't know when it's going to happen.
Right.
I'm just telling you it's not going to happen now.
Right.
So he's got like two answers to the question.
Yes.
Say, when are you coming back? Or when's this all going to take place? He goes, well, it's not going to be now.
Right.
Because right now you're going to go through hell.
Right.
But it's going to happen later, but I can't tell you when.
That's right. That's right. Well, he's saying, and it depends on what it is. On the question of when is Jerusalem going to be destroyed, the way he predicted, he's saying, it's not now, but it's going to be within a generation. If we're talking about my return, I don't even know when that is. But what these parables are about to say is, I'm warning you in advance. You need to be prepared for it to be a short time or a long time or any possible amount of time. What you're facing now is the choice of whether you're going to be following me and thus be prepared when I return or not. That's the important thing. See, it's not over and done with now. You can't say, okay, I voted for you and you won, so let's go. Rather, in a sense, it's just beginning. I'm going to be gone. This place is going to be gone. And there's going to be this period of time when people are going to face the question, do I believe this or not? And am I going to follow this or not? So that's really his answer to them is, because it's not happening immediately, I need to prepare you for the fact that it could be a long time and that very important questions are going to be faced by you and by everyone that follows me because I'm not going to be here the way you're expecting me to be. Does that make sense? Before I go into the parables here, is there any other question about any of that other stuff or comments you have about the... I mean, I don't have a lot to say about the pre-tribulation rapture and all of that kind of stuff.
Just one question. Do you see the destruction of Jerusalem as some sort of... as an event that is contributing to some sort of... divine plan going on? Or is it just sort of... It feels more comfortable for me to say, when Jesus says this is going to happen, he's not plotting out sort of sacred history and showing these things have to happen for this sort of thing to happen, but he's just saying, look, the world's a really tumultuous place, and there's some pretty significant rebellious sects within Judaism right now, and Rome isn't going to take it for very long. I guess what I'm asking is, do you see that as a really significant event in terms of salvation
Yes.
history or something, or is there really a salvation history to talk about other than Jesus Christ coming and dying
Right.
and leaving?
Right. I think it is. I mean, I know you said which one you felt more comfortable with, but unfortunately, I'm going to say the other one. So, you can take and do with that what you want. But When we talk about salvation history, I mean, there's different ways that we could talk about that, but part of what we have to recognize is that all the way back to Abraham, there is this promise that God has been making that He is going to be the God of Israel. And there are significant promises that He makes to them along the way, so that those times when He enters into judgment with Israel are significant events in salvation history, in the sense that they are God coming along and saying to the people that He promised this great blessing to, you need to understand that this is about trust, this is about faith in Me, and so on, and you reject Me and there are going to be consequences. So certainly the Babylonian captivity is a tremendous event in salvation history in that sense. I mean, the prophets speak about it at great lengths as the judgment of God that's coming upon Israel, and it's coming upon them because of their unbelief. Moses had predicted that very thing in saying to them essentially, look, I'm laying before you the blessing and the curse. If you choose to fall away from God, the curse is what's going to happen. But he essentially says, Moses essentially says, that is what's going to happen. I mean, you're going to turn away from God, and God is going to level the place. And then he talks about a return, ultimately, when God circumcises their hearts, and he brings them back together, and he is their God, and so on. So right from the beginning, there's this clear message that the people of Israel are ultimately going to be redeemed from their rebellion and unbelief against God, but that there are going to be chapters in this story. Well, my understanding at this point is that, especially in the prophet Daniel, that it had been made relatively clear as it could be in something as strange as the visions in Daniel, that there still remained in the history of Israel the wrath of God was still waiting to be poured out on them one more time. And I think that Jesus portrays the destruction of Jerusalem in those terms. It's not just it's a volatile political situation, but he speaks about, he talks to them and says that these things were coming upon them because you did not recognize the day of your visitation. And he says these are days of wrath, days that have been appointed. I mean, I think he sees the Gentiles overrunning Jerusalem and the people being taken out into the nations, all the nations, as being the final chapter of this long story of the discipline of God on the nation of Israel. But all of the prophetic messages say that ultimately that discipline is going to result in the redemption of Israel, and that Israel still has this unique place as God's people. That's what I understand the prophets to be talking about. So, and I suppose as I'm saying this, I ought to make a qualification, because there are those who would say that having a view like this, that the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD was a judgment of God that came upon the people of Israel, and to even further make the claim that it is related to their ultimate rejection of God as represented by the fact that they took and crucified the Messiah when he showed up. In one sense, that makes a great deal of sense. I mean, if God brought in the Babylonians because they were worshiping idols, why wouldn't it make sense that the Romans would come in when they take their king and crucify him? But that kind of thinking has been used, I think, and very wrongly used to justify a kind of anti-Semitism. Well, anti-Semitism itself, to say, well, you know, they got what they deserved, and you know, Jews are Christ killers, and all that kind of stuff. And to use this sort of, to use Jesus language about, you know, that these are days of wrath that have come upon them to justify that sort of thing, I think is really wrong. And what's helpful as a model, I think, is to go back and look at the way the prophets talk about the judgment of Israel from the Babylonians and the Assyrians and so on. Because in the prophets, you have the prophet will be addressing Israel, addressing Judah, and saying, look, you know, you've followed idols, you haven't paid any attention to me, you don't care a single thing about what I think or what is important or the fact that I'm here. The Babylonians are coming and this is going to be my discipline, my judgment upon you as a nation that you have turned away from me. And after speaking very strongly to them in those terms, he turns around and he talks to the Babylonians and the Assyrians and he says, how dare you raise your hand against my people? Man, are you in trouble? You see what I'm saying? God, at one and the same time, God is saying, this is coming upon you, Israel, to teach you, to warn you, to discipline you, to show you that how serious a thing it is to turn away from God. But that in no way justifies the behavior of the Babylonians and the Assyrians in coming in and beating up on the Jews. That doesn't mean that God turns to them and says, good job, guys, I'm really glad that you went in there without concern for compassion or anything like that and just beat the heck out of everybody. That's what I like to see in somebody. That's not what he says. He says, no, I mean, there's a great evil that you've done here. So I know that it's difficult to reconcile those two things. It takes some thinking to see how would those two things fit together. But I would argue that the same thing is true, that the way we look at what has happened to Israel as a nation since the time of Christ, that on the one hand, Jesus has told us, I think, that look, that you turned away from your king out of evil motives, out of unbelief, out of worldliness, out of a disregard for the things of God, and judgment is going to come upon you. But at the same time, that in no way justifies. I mean, if we look at the Holocaust as a great example of the terrible things that have happened to the Jews since that time, in one sense we can say it is a part of the judgment of God that has come upon the nation, that they didn't have a place to live, that they had to be living in Poland and Germany and those places, and this stuff came upon them. But at the same time, what the Nazis did was evil. It wasn't okay because it was the Jews and they killed Christ. It was evil. And the judgment of God is rightly going to come upon them for having done that. So, yeah, I think the reason that Jesus is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem here is because it is a significant event. And in one sense, it is the event that the prophets had talked about that still remained to happen before the kingdom of God could come in its fullness. That's why in the Olivet Discourse he paints the picture of the destruction of Jerusalem as being this sign. In a sense, when you see this happen, he says, lift up your head, for your redemption is drawing nigh. And I think what he means is, I mean, for the way I'm understanding the thing, he has to mean not, so I'm going to be here tomorrow when you see this happen, but rather recognize that now the thing that I predicted has come to pass, showing, number one, that I was right, I was reliable in what I had said, but also that this final thing that had to come in the ultimate plan of God for the nation of Israel has now come. And so all that remains to happen is that final thing, the final redemption, when Jesus returns and finally establishes a people for himself and establishes his kingdom. So, yeah, it is, I think, I don't see any way around it. I mean, I think the Bible is describing it in those terms as being a significant event in the plan of God for Israel, who are truly a unique people to him. And the fact that there was great unbelief among them, I mean, the Gentiles are not particularly noted for our belief either, so it's not as if there's any different than we are. It's just, the striking thing for them is, whereas the rest of the world just sort of trotted merrily along, happily unbelieving, Israel is that group of people that God came to, revealed Himself to, showed Himself to, and demonstrated to us how deep the problem of sin and rebellion goes in us. Because, you know, like David was showing us in Exodus, it takes, we're prepared to look at great, miraculous demonstrations of the power of God and then turn away in unbelief, essentially. And Israel was a nation that was chosen to demonstrate what, in very real ways, what we're like as human beings, as well as those individuals like Abraham and David and so on, who were called upon to demonstrate what faith in God looked like and how powerful a thing that could be. Okay, so think about that. Let's see what you think. Okay. Where are we? Who then is the faithful and sensible slave whom his master put in charge of his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all of his possessions. But if that evil slave says in his heart, "My master is not coming for a long time," and shall begin to beat his fellow slaves and eat and drink with drunkards, the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour which he does not know, and shall cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites. Weeping shall be there and the gnashing of teeth. Okay. Well, it seems to me that this first of these little parables is intended to make a certain kind of point here. Notice the problem here is this slave, he's at home, he's been given a charge that he's supposed to take care of, but the master is gone. And the next day he's gone, and the next day he's gone, and he gets to thinking, hey, he's not here. What am I worried about? If he were here, there's no way that I would just do whatever I want, because boy, would I get it. But he's not here. And, you know, for all I know, he could be a long time in coming. So I've got freedom here. I can do what I want. And he starts, you know, as we see, the picture of he's eating and drinking with drunkards and beating his fellow slaves and generally doing things that are irresponsible, faithless, in that he's not carrying out the tasks that he was given to carry out. But the point is, why is he doing it? In this story, it's because he's got this sense, because the master's away, I don't have to deal with him. You know, when the cat's away, the mice will play kind of thing. And that's what Jesus is painting in this picture is, look, I can see how there's a kind of thinking that could develop when I'm telling you that it's going to be, it could be a long time before I return. One way of dealing with that is, hey, it's a long time before he returns. I don't have to deal with that now. I can do what I want. Well, what's going to happen to the person in that situation? The master's going to show up at an hour you don't expect. That is, if you're counting on him being a long time, then his arrival is going to be too soon for you. You're cruising along, doing what you want, and all of a sudden, he's here. And now I have to give an account for what it is I've been doing. So this parable is meant to give an immediate sort of image that they could identify with, that we can identify with, to show how his absence could be a kind of a stumbling block for many people. And in this case, it's a stumbling block because he's gone a long time. Someone has this idea that he's not going to be here for a long time, and so I'm free to do what I want. And so the error here is to fall into the thinking that because he's not here, I don't have to worry about him for some time to come. And in this parable, what we see is ultimately, if you think that because he's not here, you don't have to deal with him, then his coming is going to be too soon for you. Okay? Is that? Let me compare that with, I'll talk about this next parable briefly and then we'll stop. Because I think there's a kind of a on the one hand, on the other hand, happening here. Then the kingdom of heaven will be comparable to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. And 5 of them were foolish, and 5 were prudent. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the prudent took oil in flasks along with their lamps. Now while the bridegroom was delaying, they all got drowsy and began to sleep. But at midnight there was a shout, "Behold, the bridegroom, come out to meet him." Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the prudent, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the prudent answered, saying, "No, there will not be enough for us and you too. Go instead to the dealers and buy some for yourselves." And while they were going away to make the purchase, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding feast, and the door was shut. And later the other virgins also came, saying, "Lord, Lord, open up for us." But he answered and said, "Truly I say to you, I do not know you. Be on the alert then, for you do not know the day nor the hour." Well, see, a lot has been done with this parable. I don't know. Now, I've heard a number of things taught with this. We ask ourselves, well, what does the oil represent? And then somebody will say, well, oftentimes the oil represents the Holy Spirit. And so this is a story about how if you don't have a personal relationship with Christ and have the Holy Spirit inside you, then you won't be accepted when he comes back or something like that. Which is, I mean, that may be fine, but I don't think that's what this parable is teaching. Remember, what I'm arguing is that the thing that ties all these parables together is this idea that the problem of Jesus' absence, that his absence represents a problem that we have to deal with. In the former story, it was the person thinks, oh, he's not coming for a long time, so I don't have to deal with him. In this story, the problem is that 5 of these maidens didn't get the idea that he might be a long time in coming. They're waiting for the bridegroom. They all go out. They have lamps, and evidently they're burning these lamps while they're waiting. So through the night, the lamps that they've got are burning. And then they all fall asleep. Falling asleep is sometimes an image in the Bible that's used of falling away, you know, not being faithful, not being aware. But here it's not a problem because they all fall asleep. But when the bridegroom finally comes, it's a lot longer than they were expecting. And so they had used up the oil that they had in their lamps while they were waiting for him to come. Well, the wise ones had brought along a flask of oil so that they could fill their lamps in case he was a long time in coming and they ran out of the oil that they had. They could fill their lamps and then they'd have the light that they needed to travel along the road with him to go to the wedding feast, because they were part of a procession that was heading to the... Gosh, I've forgotten how this works. Is it they're heading to the bride's house or is it to the bridegroom's house? I forget which way it works. Does anyone remember? Right. The groom is coming and they escort him. I can't remember if it's to the bride's house or if somehow he's gone away to get the bride and he's bringing her back to his house. I can't remember. Doesn't matter. But see, the idea is that they're going to be a part of this wedding procession, but the 5 foolish maidens here can't go along in this wedding procession because they're going to fall flat on their faces because they don't have any light to go along with it. And why don't they have any light? Because they didn't count on the fact that the bridegroom might be late in coming. And I think the point of the story is as simple as that, is that all the oil represents is that determination, that understanding that I'm going to have to hold out for a long time, maybe. I'm going to have to have this stuff that's going to carry me through all the way until he comes. And what he's warning against is that sort of a superficial kind of interest that would be prepared in a sense if he were to come back quickly. Okay, yeah, then I'd be ready. But if he's a long time in coming, then I might not be ready. That's what happened to the 5 maidens here. They hadn't thought when they set out to do this, he might be a long time in coming back. What is the wisdom of the other maidens? Their wisdom is knowing he might be a long time in coming back. So I think what Jesus is trying to get across here is, in the first story, it's the servant gets cocky and thinks, he's going to be a long time. Then the master shows up too soon. In this story, they're being presumptuous and not counting on the fact that he might be a long time in coming. And in this story, he shows up too late. They weren't prepared for him to be that long in coming. I think it fits with, you may remember at the end of the parable of the unjust judge, Jesus sort of rhetorically asked the question, however, when the Son of Man returns, will he find faith on the earth? I mean, when he finally comes back, is there going to be anyone left expecting him? Or will everyone have given up? What Jesus is trying to do with this story is saying, you need to have that thing that it takes to go all the way to the end, to go the distance, so that when I finally return, you'll be prepared for me.
49.
I can't hear you because of the fan.
49.
49?
I mean, he puts him in charge of everything that he owns, but then he gets to beat his fellow slaves. Can you talk about that? I mean,
I'm sorry.
Obviously he wasn't ready for the return. Can't hear me?
No, the fan, I'm sorry. Maybe my hearing's going.
About the slave parable.
Okay.
Where he puts them in all.
Right.
He says, here's all my possessions.
Come right.
Going away. I'm coming
right.
Back. I mean, obviously he wasn't ready, but I think it's significant too in verse 49 that he says, and he began to beat his fellow slaves and keep them drinking with drunkards. I mean,
right.
Can you kind of put that in perspective in terms of being ready? I mean, I think
right. Right.
Which doesn't really talk about it necessarily,
give
you a real clear picture about the
virgin. Right, right. No, that's right. In the parable about the servant who's left in charge, he brings out the moral element of what it means not to be ready for his return. There, he feels the freedom to be disobedient. And I think that's intended to carry over. I mean, Jesus is saying essentially that we, in a sense, have been put in charge of all his possessions. I mean, he went away and here is his world. But do we feel the freedom to ignore his wishes and do what we want and pursue evil in the midst of it? You're right. In the story of the 10 maidens, there's nothing evil about what they did. And in the story, you'll notice the bridegroom doesn't say, throw them out into the outer darkness where the hypocrites are with the gnashing of teeth. He just says, I don't know you. And I think the idea is that, and I think Jack would disagree with me on this, but I think the idea is that when he came, it would be a natural sort of thing that the people who were there to meet him, he would come to know them in this progression on the way to the party, on the way to this big wedding bash. But they weren't there. They weren't a part of this. And so at the end, they come to the door and he says, who are you? You weren't out there as a part of the wedding party. I didn't see you. The analogy there is only on the state of readiness. Are you prepared for the fact that it might be a long time? They didn't beat up anybody or eat and drink with drunkards, but the story is intended to illustrate what can happen if you're not prepared for it being a long time. If he had told a different sort of story, the fact is that being unprepared for his coming being a long time has moral consequences as well. If I give up on his coming, I may do the same sort of thing, go and do what I want and stop believing in him and following him and so on. But he's picking his stories to bring out certain parts of the thing. You're right, there is a difference in that there's nothing really wrong with the maidens, they weren't wise. But that wisdom is what he wants to concentrate on. Well, we're at the end of our time here. So I think probably next week, I suspect, will be the last week of talking about this stuff in Matthew. And I'm not sure where we'll be going from there.